for our audience of blind and print impaired listeners, your North Carolina Reading Service presents The Indie Week, and this week's issue, read by John Federson, is dated May 24th of 2024. Our one-hour program is going to begin right now, as soon as I turn down our music. And we'll begin with a couple of budget-related articles. I know we're thrilled to hear about that. Starting in Raleigh, with the Raleigh City Council meeting last Tuesday. I'm recording this on Thursday. City Manager Marshall Adams-David presented her 1.4 billion dollar budget proposal. That's a 12% increase over last fiscal year. Marshall Adams-David's emphasized the growth in city expenditures continues to outpace the growth in revenues. Sales revenues, she noted, are leveling off. Following post-pandemic growth and the demand for city services are soaring as services become more costly to provide. After county property revaluations this year increased home values by 52% on average, the city budget will actually reduce the city's property tax rate from 43.3 cents for every $100 of value down to 35.5 cents. But homeowners will still be paying more. The revenue neutral rate is 31.7 cents per hundred in value. On a home worth $390,000, Raleigh's new median home value, a homeowner can expect to pay an annual tax bill of $1,390. The budget also increases water rates in the city by $1.58 per month, and solid waste services by $1.70 per month. City bus fares could return this summer as well, after they were eliminated during the pandemic years. Part of the new revenues will pay for salary increases for city workers. The budget makes market rate pay adjustment of 5% for public safety workers, including firefighters, police officers, and 9/11 operators. 6% increases for maintenance and operations specialists, and 9% increases for supervisors in the city's solid waste, transportation, water and parks, recreation, and cultural resources departments. All other city workers will receive 2% raises. The budget will also make merit adjustments for public safety officers, and it will raise the rates for part-time and starting workers by 1%. Now, there are other budget highlights, and these include an allocation of $800,000 to the city's police budget for the ACORNS units, and that sends social workers out to respond to some 9/11 calls. $800,000. A dedicated one penny of that tax rate is to go towards affordable housing initiatives, resulting in an increase of $3.5 million, including $500,000 to assist people in danger of losing their homes. There's an investment in Dix Park, D-I-X, including new bond-funded positions and $8.6 million in spending from the city's capital improvement programs as the Gibson Play Plaza opens this year, and the city takes over 3 state-owned buildings. And there are additional positions for the oversight of downtown parks, including Moore Square, Nash Square, and Latitude University Historic Park. Now, on June 4th, the city will hold a public hearing on the proposed budget. And this was from Jane Porter, editor-in-chief, this article. Next, we go over to Durham, the Durham City Manager's budget proposal. This article written on May the 20th. Durham City Manager Wanda Page will present her recommendations for Durham's 24-25 fiscal year budget at the City Council's regular meeting this evening. Again, that was to be on the 20th. While it's not the final budget, the manager's presentation will be a good indication of what the priorities are going into the next year. Big considerations loom over the budget discussion. How will the city address its public safety challenges? Will city workers get the raises they've been fighting for? Here are five things for you to keep an eye on going into tonight's presentation. Again, this meeting has already taken place. Will the city continue its large investments in transportation infrastructure? Pressure from the bicycle and pedestrian communities last year led the City Council to include a Vision Zero coordinator position in this outgoing budget. The position was part of a large investment in transportation that included more bus shelters and bike lanes. Now the bike-ped community has bolder ambitions. Advocates are asking the city to invest in substantial capital improvement projects, including completing Durham's sidewalk network, converting Roxborough and Mangum Street to two-way streets with help from the state government, and keeping the local Go Durham buses fare-free. Some of these, by the way, has connected to articles you already heard here on Indy Week in past weeks. Will city workers get the raises they've been fighting for? They've been fighting for stronger compensation dating back to last year's tumultuous budget cycle. One-time bonuses were doled out to city employees in October, but workers remain steadfast in their goal to get permanent raises on the books, citing the ever more burdensome cost of living in the area during public hearings and public demonstrations. Durham County prioritized employee pay in the county manager's recent budget proposal, which puts even more pressure on the City Council to invest in its employee base. Of the major considerations during tonight's discussion, this seems the highest priority. How will the city respond to gun violence and other public safety issues? Recent spikes in gun violence have ripped through the Durham community and centered public safety as a preeminent issue for city staff. In March, the council voted not to renew its contract with Sound Thinking, owners of the ShotSpotter gunfire detection technology. Residents pushed the city council to invest in alternative public safety methods, like the holistic empathetic assistive response team called HART, and alternative public safety methods. These programs, an Office of Survivor Care. These programs are part of the city's holistic approach to public safety, but it is unclear if they are designed to address the immediate challenge that guns on the street present. How can the city redirect funds intended for ShotSpotter into effective tools that tackle the pressing issue of gun violence while meeting the other requests from residents? Small business owners say they're still struggling post-pandemic. What investments will the city make to help small businesses thrive? They say they're still rebounding from lingering effects of the COVID pandemic. More people are working from home. That hurts foot traffic, and the effects of inflation have forced employers to raise their prices and increase their payroll to support their staff. Parking. Disruptive construction projects and public safety are also issues business owners cite as barriers to recapturing the pre-pandemic numbers. Funds from the American Rescue Plan Act helped prop up businesses during lockdown. They are all but depleted, so the city will have to find new ways to support the local economy. Mayor Leonardo Williams, a small business owner himself, has publicly voiced concern about the conditions for Durham's small businesses, though it's unclear what specific measures the city will take to attract residents back to the city's major commercial districts. And a final question, Will the city raise taxes? That question has been a mainstay, as Durham's growing population has greatly increased its service needs in recent years. The prospect of raising taxes was addressed when the new city council first took office last December. At the time, no council members committed to a tax increase, but with mounting project needs and a limited set of tools to raise revenue, pushing off a tax increase seems untenable. Mayor Williams has made an effort to bring in more funding through private-public partnerships and federal grant programs, but can those sources support long-term sustainability for the city's new initiatives? And finally, the City Council will host its second public hearing coming up on June the 3rd, before taking their final vote on the budget on June the 17th. Now, that prior article did talk about a Tuesday meeting. This was another article, short article, that occurred before the meeting, and it's about the school system request. The county's commitment to education courses continues to be unwavering. I'm just going to start that one again to make sure I have the whole article. I didn't, and here's the opening paragraph. Durham County Manager Kimberly Sowell presented a recommended $955 million budget to county commissioners on Monday. This is the county budget. And while the budget includes $200 million for Durham Public Schools, a $13 million increase, the proposal is still $14 million short of the school board's request. The county's commitment to education continues to be unwavering, emphasized Sowell. DPS continues to be the single largest expenditure for Durham County government at 32% of the entire general fund budget. The recommended budget will result in a 3.25-cent tax increase, raising the countywide tax to 78.5 cents per $100 of property valuation. Yet, it falls short of what school system leaders requested. In April, the Durham School Board voted to request a $27 million increase in local funding for this upcoming year after months of protests from DPS employees and the community. The proposal would allow for pay raises for support staff, certified employees, and classified employees. Sowell acknowledged this funding discrepancy. Due to slowing revenue growth, higher service demands, and higher costs, she said she was unable to recommend DPS request budget in full. I'm aware, she said, that remaining funding gaps exist within the district. She suggested that county leaders meet routinely with school system representatives over the course of the year to strategize together on how to meet DPS remaining needs. She also noted the school system has received several recent funding increases, saying that with this appropriation and recommended budget, DPS annual county funding will have increased by almost $47 million over 4 years. In response, the interim superintendent, Kathy Quiroz-Moore, released a statement promising continued efforts to secure more funding. Quote, "Our sincere and fervent hope is that we will all continue to advocate for the additional funds and support needed to ensure that our students and teachers are resourced with high-quality academic support and safe, conducive learning and work facilities," said Moore. "We are all accountable for the win, that being our student success and our employee recruitment and retention." For 2024-25, education continues to make up the bulk of the county's general fund expenditures at 34.5%. Educational expenses include support for Durham Technical Community College, pre-K, and Durham Public Schools. In addition to the 7% increase in funding for DPS, Durham Tech funding will see a 1.9% increase, and pre-K will see an increased investment of almost $1 million. Other budget increases include $13.3 million, which will provide a 3% raise to county employees, $1.4 million for the Eviction Diversion Program, and $845,000 in additional funding for the Durham County Sheriff's Office. With several requests and recommendations on the table, and a $14 million funding discrepancy looming, school funding promises to draw continued discussion at the public hearing on this county budget on May the 28th at 7 p.m. All right, let's stay with Durham schools now and their plan called Growing Together. This was written on the 17th of May. At a school board meeting in early March, a group of administrators shared updates on Growing Together, a reassignment plan going into effect in elementary schools this fall. When the slide presentation ended, board member Millicent Rogers asked what seemed like a simple question. She asked, how many touches do I as a parent need to have with DPS to ensure that my students have care in the fall for their academic needs, transportation needs, and their after-school needs? Rogers wanted to know what parents need to do and when to make sure their kids' school years start smoothly. It took three administrators more than 15 minutes to answer the question. So Rogers said, please accept my apology for asking a difficult question. I think it's difficult for parents to navigate. Interim Superintendent Kathy Moore replied, if you're a parent and you're trying to walk through all of those changes, you're going to be confused. Now, Growing Together marks Durham's first reassignment plan in three decades. The first phase goes into effect next school year and will affect elementary assignments across the city. School system leaders say the plan is intended to address under- and overcrowding issues and to advance diversity, equity, and access among the schools. It includes sweeping changes for many Durham elementary schools, including curriculum, calendar, and student reassignments. But many parents call the plan growing pains and say it is broad and overly complex. They say they're frustrated by what they describe as a complicated rollout. As the school year draws to a close, parents complain about fragmented information, confusing applications, and a lack of information sharing between central administrators and the schools. Some, particularly those who have requested transfers from their assigned schools, say they don't know where their elementary school's children will attend in the fall, and they don't understand the process for getting the answers. Seeking clarity on those reassignment questions, parents say they have to talk to several different people at schools and within DPS administration. Sometimes the answers they get are conflicting. Lauren Sartain, the PTA president at E.K. Powell School, told board members in March, school staff and families are confused about where students will show up in the fall. District leaders, meanwhile, express confidence. At the same board meeting in early March, DPS Assistant Superintendent Deborah Pittman said, quote, we feel like we're well positioned to launch our schools with the opening of the year-round schools in July. When asked to comment for this particular article, Crystal Roberts, a spokeswoman for the school system, said, quote, from the inception of Growing Together, DPS has been committed to ensuring the process was inclusive and transparent. Girija Mahajan, a parent of two Power students with a background in public education, has paid close attention to Growing Together from the start. She says the simultaneous reassignment plan and classified pay issues have created a, quote, condition of chaos that she worries will strain the district's search for a new superintendent. Quote, our school system is struggling to complete the two most critical functions, student enrollment and staff payroll. This thrusts confusion and uncertainty into thousands of Durham households. Growing together includes a wide range of changes. The plan, in the works for years, splits Durham County into five regions with comparable school options in each: neighborhood schools, specialized magnet schools, including year-round dual language immersion, Montessori, and international baccalaureate schools. Some neighborhood elementaries will become magnet schools next year, which means new curriculum for teachers and students, and in some cases, new calendars. Each magnet will have a base area where families can automatically enroll, and some will accept lottery applications for students outside their base region. The number of year-round schools will more than double with the addition of Hope Valley, W.G. Pearson, Oak Grove, and Eastway. Four elementaries will transition to these dual language programming: Holt, Merrick Moore, Club Boulevard, and Lyons Farm. One elementary school, Little River, will become the district's third Montessori school, and one, E.K. Powell, will become an additional international baccalaureate school. The plan will reassign some 2,000 elementary students to new schools come fall, according to past estimates, but there are exceptions. Fourth and fifth graders can remain at their current schools, and their younger siblings can stay for a year or two. Families zoned for specific specialized programs, such as year-round or dual-language schools, who want to send their children to other schools, can apply for an opt-out or hardship transfer, though these transfers are not guaranteed. After-school programs, meanwhile, have a separate application process. As a result, parents whose children need after-school care, as well as instruction, must pursue two different application processes. The Durham School District has made a number of efforts to inform families about Growing Together plan and seek feedback, including holding meetings, conducting surveys, sharing announcements, and producing videos. Yet, many Durham families remain confused. Though many parents support the goals that inspired Growing Together, diversity, equity, and access, they say they are concerned about its execution. Parents seeking exceptions to their assigned schools, like hardship transfers or opt-outs, say that process is particularly bewildering. Jenna Crowther has been outspoken with her concerns about Growing Together during school board meetings. Her eldest child is a first grader at E.K. Powell who has been reassigned to a different school for next year. At a school board meeting in March, Crowther told the board that when her daughter asked where she would attend school next year, she didn't know what to say. Staff told Crowther to apply to Powell with a hardship transfer application for next year, but the application did not list Powell as an option, she says. She called administration for guidance and was told to select her base school as the transfer school and write in Powell in an open notes section of the application. She told the board, I hope you can see that I have trouble trusting in this guidance. Please remember that you're dealing with people, families, and children, especially children who need to be able to trust what they are told by DPS, to trust the technology used, and be able to plan their lives. Teresa Blackington, who has a second and fourth grader at Club Boulevard, says she feels parents' concerns about Growing Together go unheard at board meetings and in feedback sessions. She says parents tell school system leaders they want strong, fully staffed schools with a thorough curriculum. What I don't hear people saying is, I want a lottery system. I want wait lists. I want to be zoned out of the school my child currently attends. People weren't looking for special programs. Dowell Blackington was able to keep both her children at club for the upcoming school year after a series of administrative gymnastics. But many of her children's friends are leaving that school. Four in her younger daughter's class left to attend Central Park School for Children. That's a charter in downtown Durham, seeking more stability. Online, there's a chorus of confused parents, and that's taken to Facebook groups to post about their situations and seek guidance. They wonder whether their children will be accepted off of wait lists. They worry about neighborhood schools that are transitioning to year-round schedules, dual language, or other specialized programs. Some ask for advice on transferring to private or charter schools. Many post to the Facebook groups anonymously. Numerous parents interviewed for this story asked to speak anonymously, too. They expressed fear that publishing their names would negatively impact active school applications. Samar Simmons, an E.K. Powell mom, says some Durham families have been reluctant to share their experiences, saying, "There is a sentiment of folks being hesitant on providing feedback and sharing their experience because it will be dismissed or fall on deaf ears, all under the guise of change is hard," she said. The change is coming. Dowell Blackington said, "Next year is going to happen, and there's not a lot we can do about it. What I would like to see from the district is a true, honest evaluation of growing together as implementation happens, and a willingness to be truthful about what worked and what didn't." I think the last specifically Board of Education or education-related stories comes from Orange County, and it was written about a week ago. On a rainy Tuesday, voters turned out to give incumbent Bonnie Hauser another four-year term on the Orange County Schools Board of Education. Preliminary results show Hauser received a decisive 64% of the nearly 4,000 votes cast in the runoff between her and Jennifer Moore, another incumbent. The runoff, which Hauser requested after she came in fourth place behind Moore in the March election for three board seats, was not without drama. On election day, some voters filled in ballots by phone flashlight because their polling place lost power. Precinct results show Moore won a majority of voters in Hillsborough and the adjacent precincts, West Hillsborough and Grady Brown, as well as Patterson to the south. The candidates tied in Hillsborough East, and Hauser won the rest of the precincts, with particularly strong support in Caldwell and Carr to the north. In previewing the election, the Indy detailed the drama of the past month as Moore resigned from the board and all but withdrew from the election, after the News and Observer reported she did not have a doctoral degree as she had previously claimed. Even as she said she was not running for the seat anymore, it was too late for election officials to take her name off the ballot. After she resigned, her supporters continued to campaign, not for Moore as so much as against Hauser. They hoped that if Moore won the seat, the board would have to find a consensus pick to appoint for the term. Hauser's re-election means the board will likely continue on its current trajectory because the membership will stay nearly identical. Carrie Doyle won her re-election in March, and Wendy Padilla will be the only newcomer to the board when she is sworn in over the summer. While most of the board's votes have been unanimous, Hauser was in the majority in a few key 4-3 votes over the past 2 years. In a statement released Wednesday, Hauser thanked her supporters and said she looks forward to future conversations. Tuesday may have marked the last ever runoff for the Orange County School Board as State Senator Greg Meyer filed a bill to switch to a purely plurality-based system, citing the Jim Crow roots of runoff elections. Well, I was mistaken about No more education stories. Here's one. Durham leaders hope that 2024 will be different for local workforce housing legislation. This was written by Greg Childress on the 16th of May. Durham officials are hoping for the best this legislative short session, knowing the worst is likely to come, regarding a bill to allow the Board of Education and the county to build workforce housing on public land for teachers, law enforcement officers, and first responders. Durham lawmakers have filed bills year after year asking colleagues in the House and Senate to support efforts to build workforce housing in Durham, where gentrification and a shortage of affordable, quality rental property has severely stretched the paychecks of people working in the public sector. But the Republican-led General Assembly has refused to take up the bill, dating to at least 2017. Critics have said allowing public land to be used for affordable housing would erode the Umsted Act, which bars the government from competing with private business. Last week, Representative Vernetta Alston, Democrat of Durham, filed House Bill 1067, Employee Housing Durham County, that would allow workforce housing in Durham. Senator Mike Woodard, Democrat of Durham, filed a companion bill, Senate 905. Alston says she isn't sure why past bills have not been taken up by the General Assembly. Quote, "It's a local bill. To me, it feels pretty straightforward in terms of just giving our local jurisdiction the ability to support their employees, particularly in a moment when housing is really hard to come by for folks of all income levels, but particularly for our public servants. It's a local matter that's overdue for being taken up by the General Assembly." Does Alston think the bill will gain enough support to be heard this time around? "That's the hope, always," she said. Despite lawmakers' concern about workforce housing in Durham, several other communities have been green-lighted to build such housing with help from the State Employees Credit Union Foundation. The credit union provided interest-free loans for workforce housing. The newest one in Bertie County is scheduled to open this summer in time for the 24-5 school year. Most workforce housing complexes have been built on property donated by counties or owned by school districts. Legislative approval is needed for this initiative because of laws to, quote, prevent state and local government from aiding or interfering with the private sector, says Tyler Mulligan, a professor at UNC School of Government. If approved, the law would allow Durham County Board of Education and the county to enter into a partnership, joint venture, land trust, or similar arrangement to construct, provide, and maintain affordable housing on property now owned by the Board of Education. The workforce housing would be restricted to teachers employed by Durham Public Schools, sworn law enforcement officers, or other first responders employed by local governments in Durham County. The bill also allows the partnerships to contract with any person or business entity to finance, construct, or maintain this affordable housing. The housing units can be rented at reasonable, potentially below market rates, with 75% of the units being reserved for teachers. The bill does not exempt the constructed housing from compliance with building codes, zoning ordinances, or other health and safety regulations. Durham School Board member Natalie Bayer says, "I think there's more need than ever for workforce housing and urban parts of the state. It's incredible we've been at this so long and still need to make progress." In 2017, the Durham School Board approved a State Employees Credit Union proposal to build housing for teachers on the former Lowe's Grove Elementary School site in southern Durham near Research Triangle Park. That project never happened. Other sites could be under consideration, Bayer said, if lawmakers pass the bill. In 2019, a bill filed by the late former Senator Mary Ann Black, Democrat of Durham, never saw the light of day after some Republican lawmakers complained that allowing workforce housing to be built in Durham would lead to government competing with private industry. Byers says, we have to stay optimistic that local bills will move forward and not be blocked in partisan ways. I'm glad the bills includes firefighters and law enforcement officers and gives us some option as we work to retain educators. Supporters of workforce housing see it as a way to retain teachers. Many educators say they're leaving the profession because they're underpaid and underappreciated. The teacher turnover rate in the state has increased 47%, according to the State of the Teaching Profession report released in April. The bottom line, say supporters, the teacher salaries have not kept pace with housing costs. North Carolina's average teacher salary is about $56,000, which is nearly $13,000 below the national average. Pay for starting teachers is $40,000, which places the state 42nd in the nation and almost $15,000 below the minimum living wage. A North Carolina Housing Coalition report recently found that it costs $1,600 a month to rent a moderately priced two-bedroom apartment in Durham. An income of $65,000 per year is needed to afford fair market rents in Durham, the coalition found. And according to the report, the average salary for an elementary school teacher in Durham is $31,000 for a child care worker, $35,000 for a firefighter. 40% of renters in the county have difficulty affording their homes, according to this report. Some conservatives have criticized the idea of publicly supporting workforce housing. In a 2019 column making a case against teacher housing, Bob Lubke, currently on staff at the Raleigh-based John Locke Foundation, argued that rents are affordable for teachers in Durham and Bertie counties. His argument was based on teacher salaries, local supplements, and fair market rents for each county. Using that formula, he argued, teachers in both counties could find rentals that did not exceed the 30% of gross take-home pay most financial experts recommend. While that remains true in Bertie County, it's no longer true in Durham, Lubke said when asked by North Carolina Newsline. He said in an email response, a quick review of math shows starting teachers in Durham would spend about 45% of income on rent, while Bertie would expend about 26% of their income. Amid rising inflation, higher rents, and the lack of quality affordable rentals, in many locations, Lubke has not changed his mind about whether school districts should be in the business of building teacher housing. He said, school districts are not trained to be landlords, and there are many reasons why they shouldn't be. If teachers can't find affordable housing, is there a reason why raising teacher pay should not be the preferable option for addressing these concerns? Well, now, I can assure you this next article is not about the education budget. It begins this way. As you walk into the studio, you spot a couple of people sitting on their mats and your eyes dart away instinctively. You debate which row to claim with your mat, the front, where everyone will see you, the back, where you'll see everyone, or in the middle, where, well, all of the above. You opt for the front. The arrangement is a little tight, and the back of your mat grazes the one behind you. In ordinary yoga class, this might not be such a big deal, but here, everyone is naked. 25 bare bodies, evenly spaced in three rows, twist and stretch as the electric light orchestra's strange magic flows through the room. A muscled couple in the front row lie on their backs, spread their legs confidently. They've been here before. A man in the back row sways back and forth into a deep squat. Nipple piercings and rainbow tattoos dance asynchronously to the song's fitting refrain. A mirror on the front wall doubles the already dazzling sight. The room only looks like this once a month. This is Margaret Shine's nude yoga class, hosted by Durham's Three House Studio since June of 2021. The class costs $20, and it is all gender, all adult ages, and completely naked, except during COVID when participants wore nothing but masks. There's always a wait list. I made it into two classes recently and got the full experience. Turns out, nude yoga attracts a very wide range of characters, and it's not as uncomfortable as you might think. It starts like this. You enter the cozy lobby and are greeted by smiling Shine, who offers optional hugs and often details about her latest adventure in baking. You put your shoes and phone in a small cubby before entering the main room to undress. Brick walls and gray floors glow in the natural light, but the windows are too high and thick for anyone to see inside. Each spot is marked by a pair of yoga blocks that Shine carefully laid out before your arrival. After agonizing over where to put your mat, you catch a glimpse of yourself in the mirror. You pause. You're stalling, trying to delay the inevitable moment you've been fearing a little longer, but you can't think of a good excuse, so you undress. Shirts or pants off first. They'll both take you to the same stark destination, but the decision still feels important. You choose shirt, then pants, and underwear, holding eye contact with yourself in the mirror and trying to appear casual, one layer at a time. You put your clothes in an awkward jumble at the front of your mat. Maybe you should fold them? But when you look around to assess other people's strategies, your line of sight is interrupted by a butt cheek here and a bare breast there. You look down. The jumble will have to do. You are now entirely naked. Seeing your bare body in the mirror feels surprisingly familiar, like the moment right before you step into the shower, and it evokes the same feeling of deep privacy. You blink, trying to reconcile the solitude with the sea of bodies surrounding you. You feel both alone and excruciatingly seen. Everyone experiences this moment differently. For Ruth Metz, a 27-year-old massage therapist and regular attendee of Shine's class, it was natural. Her parents are European and would regularly walk around the house without clothes on when she was growing up. She says, "I've never really had that idea that nudity is a bad thing." For Dan, who asked that his last name not be used, it was a bigger leap. He was always shy, and naked yoga was, he hoped, a step on his path to becoming more confident. He swam competitively growing up and was consistently made fun of for his pale skin. He says, "I've always had this feeling like I need to cover my body to be comfortable in the space." After undressing at his first class, he started shaking, part nervous, part chilliness. Now he chats casually with the woman next to him. The class is led by Shine, 33, a seasoned instructor who also works full-time in public and mental health. She fills her life with joy and good cooking. She married her partner in a Harry Potter-themed wedding at Costco, and she populates her Instagram feed with decorated baked goods. She started practicing yoga in graduate school to relieve stress, got her teacher certification in 2020. Her approach to yoga is just as fun-loving as her approach to everything else. Even her clothed classes are unusual compared to the solemn voices and soothing music found in most studios. She creates playlists for every class, like breakup songs, animals, 90s pops, and challenges everyone to guess the theme, offering a high five as a reward. Everyone is encouraged to sing along. Her anti-capitalist rants punctuate her pose offerings, and the whole thing feels a bit more like a community gathering than a workout class. "There's a lot of corporate yoga out there," she says. "When you start teaching yoga, you sort of mimic a bunch of other people, which means you don't have your own style. But when I teach, now I tell jokes. I become much more who I am as a normal person." People respond to her authenticity. She keeps a folder on her phone full of screenshots of messages from students articulating how her yoga classes have helped them in their larger lives. She calls it her Nice Things folder. 3 years in, she is well-versed in the broad range of reactions to nudity. Once, a mother sobbed in her arms in the lobby outside the class, too anxious about the prospect of revealing her post-birth body to go in. She's texted with people who were curious about her class for over a year to help them find the courage to come. If people are nervous, she likes to offer them an analogy. "I so enjoy bungee jumping," she starts. "When you get near the edge, your body kicks in and says, 'No, no, don't do this.' It's just beautiful. Your body's protecting you. I'm not going to die, but my body doesn't know that yet." She compares this to the moment after you've rolled out your mat when self-exposure is imminent. "What's going to happen?" she'll ask a nervous student. "What are the consequences?" After a few rounds of, "I'll feel insecure, and I'll be embarrassed," usually the student will say, "Well, nothing." Shine explains that our shame does not come from sin. You're not born as a baby feeling ashamed of your thighs or your body hair or your cesarean scar. You're told to be ashamed. And by confronting that shame, she believes we can teach our bodies that nudity is nothing to fear. She believes her duty as a yoga teacher extends far beyond pure movement. She says there's a lot of emotion involved in yoga. As you move your body, you move through feelings. Her job is to guide you through both. She takes the job seriously, despite her unserious demeanor. She remembers the first class she ever taught. She began telling everyone to lift their arms into the air, and they complied. "I was just like, holy crap," she said. "Like, you don't know why I said that, and you did it." If you ever encounter a yoga teacher who doesn't recognize the weight of the responsibility they have, she says, that's terrifying. And when everyone is naked, the stakes are much higher. There's no screening process for new participants. Shine wants the experience to be open to everyone. But before each class, she sends an email with logistics and community agreements. It covers everything from the tight parking to the importance of not flirting with or objectifying people in that class. Quote, "A safe space can never be guaranteed, but this will be a brave space with every effort geared towards safety." And when people show up, she pays attention to her instincts. When a friendly old man approached her after a session and said something inappropriate, she asked him not to return. To ease the shock of the first few naked moments at the start of his class, Shine relays on her sense of humor. She runs in, still fully clothed, and races to get undressed before too much awkwardness settles in. She starts out with her go-to line. "This is nude yoga. If you're in the wrong place, I'm so sorry. You're a real sport for getting naked." Even the regulars laugh. One of her themed playlists, this time songs about magic, plays in the background as she begins the class. You cycle through some cat cows, grimacing at yourself in the mirror every time you arch your back and imagine the view for the guy behind you. The physical logistics of yoga while naked aren't too different. Body parts hang and swing in a way you expect, but don't necessarily love to see. Without fabric masking your form, you realize that your downward dog isn't quite as sharp as you imagined it. Sweat becomes a factor. Some people remain dry, but most people glisten. With each sun salutation, they look harder for remaining dry patches on their mat to plant their hands and feet. Within a few moments, though, the yoga begins to overtake the nudity. You're so focused that you start to forget. This is where things started to get easier for Dan. "As we got through familiar poses, things really did start to soften," he says. "The physicality becomes a distraction. Metz agrees. It's not so serious, she says, and she's right. After sun salutations, Shines offers a challenging pose for people to try. This class, it's an eight-angle pose. You pull your left leg over your forearm like a lazily carried backpack. Bring your hands to the mat and attempt to lift up into something of a sideways handstand. You fall down. Everybody does. Little conversations break out and people shout with excitement when they get close and laugh when they collapse in a heap of flesh. Shine offers advice and giggles with everyone else. Something about it reminds you of class in high school on a day wasn't when the teacher was in an especially good mood. You don't even come close to executing the pose, but you feel a little looser. For the amount of anticipation that plagued you before the class, it has flown by. Soon you're lying on your back with eyes closed, closing out the class with a Shavasana pose. Gentle music floats through the room. For the first time since class started, nobody can see you. It truly does not matter that you're naked. For the first time since class started, you are still. The experience begins to sink in. Later, Dan reflected on the air of communal trust in the room. He's been to 10 nude classes now and is a regular at group therapy. He sees parallels between the two. One's more physical, one's more emotional, he says. But that shared vulnerability is key and is present in both. What I love about group therapy, he says, is the encouragement to identify what you're hiding. And in nude yoga, what you hide habitually is fully exposed. He adds, that rewarding cycle of challenging yourself to do something that is atypical and new for you actually enriches your life over time. As the music fades out, you sit up. Class is over. You can put your clothes back on, but you almost don't want to. It just became easy. You stand up, take a few smug steps, staying naked just a little bit longer. Dan remembers, I felt so energized. I climbed this little mountain, this little mental barrier. At this point, Shine gives a much-anticipated announcement, what she baked for this week. Freshly baked macaroons sit on a tray in the lobby, a reward for your work. You get dressed, finally, and you try not to smile too proudly as you roll up your mat. And I'll just end that with its author of this article, Sophie Buckminster, wrote that article. Now, this last little segment is a compendium of, or compilation, let's say, of festivals of various sorts in various areas around the indie publication area. And I will just list them all on indieweek.com. They all have websites associated with them where one can find out more about prices, tickets, availability and such, but I will just have time to read them, or a few of them as I have time, about 2 minutes. And that begins on May the 23rd, Raleigh Little Theater, Movies in the Garden, Moulin Rouge. And Chapel Hill on the 25th, Carnival Circus is at the Forest Theater in Chapel Hill. Cocobooth Amphitheater, that's back in Cary, May the 30th. Trampled by Turtles with Benjamin Todd and Lost Dog Street Band. May 31, the Carolina Theater of Durham, a Small Town Murder Podcast 2024 Tour. And May 31 through June 1st is the Butner Summer Festival. Okay, here we are in June. Duke Park Meadow in Durham on June 1st. The 2024 Beaver Queen Pageant and Museum of Natural Sciences at the Prairie Ridge in Raleigh Prairie Fest. Steel String Brewery at Pluck Farm in Mebane. Still June 1, the Queer Community Picnic. And there's a handmade parade on Churton Street in Hillsborough. and the Chapel Hill Pride Promenade at Peace and Justice Plaza, beginning in Chapel Hill, June the 2nd. Carolina Theater presents Desi Banks, The Purpose Chaser Tour, on the 2nd. On June 7th, Downtown Oxford, Music on Main. In Forest City, Cherry Bounce Festival, June 7 and 8. The Apex Pride Festival is the Apex Town Campus on Hunter Street on June 8. Raleigh Little Theater brings us Kinky Boots. That's fully between June 7 and 23. June 11th, Trombone Shorty and Orleans Avenue with Big Boy. I'm sure that's a pay concert at Cocoa Booth Amphitheater, June 11th. June 13th and 28th, the American Dance Festival takes place in Durham. That's been around for decades now. And Little Feet, famous old band, the Can't Be Satisfied Tour at Cuckoo Booth. June 15th, we have several offerings. Mark Marone, All In, is at the Carolina Theater of Durham. At Vino in STEM, the Barn at Vino presents Beach Music Festival at the Barn at Vino, V-I-N-O. And the Glass Jug Beer Land in Research Triangle Park, American Summer on June 15. Then the Museum of Natural Sciences back in Raleigh, 15th through the 29th, Amazing Pollinators. And then there's Johnson Street Yacht Club Tea Dance, presented by GAG. I don't even understand that, but it's June 16th. And Carborough Juneteenth is observed at Hargraves Community Center over in Chapel Hill. June 19th, Pod Meets World Live. The Kids Want to Jump Tour is at Carolina Theater in Durham. And the 20th through the 23rd, Durham Summer Wine and Food. June 21 through 22, Flush Fest, World of Music for a Better Real World, is in West Hillsboro. All right, I've festivaled my way out of time, and John Federson will now leave you hopefully satisfied with this weekly edition of Indie Week. It's available, this broadcast, starting after its initial broadcast on Friday in the podcast section. Indie Week, IndieWeek.com, independent. John Federson for the North Carolina Reading Service saying thank you very much for listening. We'll be back next week.